We all have extraordinarily busy lives. On top of all of that, it's all the leadership roles that we take to really make a difference in the world. So the last thing in the world I want this organization to be is something that people feel they have to go to. It's not like that at all. The organization is there for you, to support you in your future leadership goals.
Welcome to Voices of Leadership, the podcast that shines a spotlight on the remarkable women of the International Women's Forum, who are reshaping industries, defying norms, and being instigators of change. I'm your host, Amy, and I'm inviting you on a journey through the minds of trailblazers. Each episode is a candid conversation where our guests will share their insights and experiences as they recount their successes, challenges, thoughts on leadership, and so much more. On today's episode, we welcome Ginny DeBanco. Ginny is a serial high achiever who has found profound fulfillment in the twilight of her life. She is a mother of two amazing children, enjoys spoiling six grandchildren, and traveling the world with her husband, Charlie, all while pursuing her post-retirement passions of fitness and nutrition. Prior to retirement, Ginny was the executive director of the Stratford Campus Digital Media Center at the University of Waterloo, and before that, dean of the School of Business and Economics at Wilfrid Laurier University. Ginny previously held a number of senior executive roles in both Bell Canada and a high-tech startup. As an IWF member, Ginny is the founder of the Waterloo chapter and a recent Luminary Award recipient. Welcome, Ginny. Thank you for being the first guest on the inaugural episode of the IWF Voices of Leadership podcast.
Ah, Amy, I must say I'm absolutely honored.
We're thrilled to have you. Since this is the first episode of the podcast, why don't we start at the beginning of your IWF journey? How did you learn about IWF?
I was in Bell Canada at the time in Toronto and had done a number of projects with an individual called Pauline Couture, who was a consultant at the time in Toronto. And apart from many other things that she brought to me, she took one look at me and she said, IWF. And I had no idea what this organization was at all. She said, come along to a meeting. I was so amazed. And let me kind of set the scene. I wasn't that kind of person that really dug in on the woman's movement, burning your bra and all that sort of thing. I really wasn't. I lived in a man's world in high tech in Toronto and finance. I didn't think that women really needed a lot of support. But man, oh man, was I surprised. There were the things that I really couldn't talk about with my buddies at work, my male friends at work. And so this provided me an opportunity to really relax. We call it under the dome. Anything that you say within an IWF context is supposed to be kept to ourselves. And I really enjoyed it. So I joined and I went to a few meetings now and again, but it was really going to conferences internationally that just blew my mind to be able to really touch bases with so many remarkable people around the world. But then I ended up being transferred through a work assignment here to Kitchener-Waterloo, and I really couldn't believe that there was no real organization at all. And it was even more than that. Women were kind of hiding. It was a real man's world here with high tech, finance, insurance, agriculture, manufacturing. So maybe there wasn't a real space for women. But I had to dig to find, and of course there were tons of talented young, older leaders here in the community. And so I went back to Toronto and begged them to start a chapter here in Kitchener-Waterloo, and voila! Man, that was probably about 15 years ago or so.
Well, we thank you for doing it. Because all of us that have joined now have that space, and we all appreciate it.
Oh, awesome.
Who did you recruit first to get things started?
Ooh, a good question. I'm pretty sure Mary Dalton was amongst the first, mm-hmm. and Joan Fisk. I think the three of us were kind of like the three amigos. And then, of course, they knew. You know, Mary and Joan know where all the bodies are buried.
They know everybody.
They know everybody and everything yes. about everybody at the time, yes. at any rate. And so they really were very helpful. And then from then on, I just sort of, in my day-over-day activities, which included talking to the leaders of commerce in the town, I just kind of kept my radar mm-hmm. Open all the time to see it when I bumped into somebody that I thought would make a good member. And we grew it from there.
I have one more, well, lots of questions yeah. about IWF, but one more specific question is that one of the foundations of IWF is that it is a no-guilt organization. And you talk a lot about that.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about why it's such an important part of IWF culture?
Yeah. And not everybody's comfortable with this, by the way, I might add, and I think it's really important. We all have extraordinarily busy lives. We do.
Yes.
You know, we have parents that need taken care of. We have children, of course, and at my age, it's children's children.
Yes.
So, and of course, on top of all of that, it's all the leadership roles that we take to really make a difference in the world. So the last thing in the world I want this organization to be is something that people feel they have to go to. It's not like that at all. It's there for you. The organization, International Women's Forum, is there for you, to support you in your future leadership goals. And it has nothing to do with having to be somewhere, you know, or feeling obligated to go. Because it is very frustrating from an organizational point of view. You organize a big event,
yes.
or you think you do, and very few people show up to it, and it makes you annoyed. And then the next exec meeting, everybody sits around and, well, you know, we have to make sure that people come out to things. Nope. That's not what this organization is about. So if we get five people out, who cares? Those five people will actually have a more intimate conversation, I'm sure, and end up with more connections that would actually help them than if the room were packed full of 50 people.
Well, you've done an excellent job building that culture here, because I have definitely felt it. Is the no guilt concept an international concept?
I don't know that, to be quite honest. I think our chapter is quite different in a number of ways, to be quite honest.
Oh.
You know, there's something about this chapter. We've brought a number of people in who are very young,
mm-hmm.
who have, I would say, more entrepreneurial roots than the typical one in Toronto, which would be big corp, a VP or a president of a big corporation. I know that many people coming here to attend our AGM from across Canada were really blown away, and primarily by one thing, and that was the way that we all work together.
Oh, interesting.
And so when we took the tours,
yes.
you know, the behind the scenes, mm-hmm. as the leaders of our various bus groups and so on, we would come into a place, let's say the Perimeter Institute, and we'd see friends that we knew,
yes.
right? And
yes.
so big hugs and everything. You don't really get the opportunity to experience that in a big city like Toronto or Montreal, Vancouver. So we're just the right size.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I didn't think about it that way, and I guess we need to appreciate it more.
Oh, my gosh.
I was at a random event yesterday and ran into Mandy Bougeau, who's a new member, and we hadn't seen each other. And again, big hugs and catching
exactly.
up. And people were like, out of context, how do you two know each other kind of thing?
I know. And it really came through in our, I mean, it wasn't part of our plan, right? We were just
adding bonus,
us,
yeah.
right? But it really, really, really came through, so much so that in Detroit, there I am sitting at the gala,
mm-hmm.
and I happened to be sitting beside a woman from Calgary, and she just would not stop telling me how much she enjoyed the time that she spent here in Kitchener-Waterloo.
Wow.
And yeah, it was about the Perimeter Institute. That's all cool stuff, right? Mm-hmm. And the quantum mm-hmm. physics and so on and so forth. But it's way more about the people.
Yes.
And there's just something, but we just feel like sisters, don't we?
Mm-hmm, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I think
there's nothing we wouldn't do for each other.
No, and I think we had lots of members. Canada Connects was their first conference or event, and so I think we also showed our own members the benefits of the conferences and whatnot too.
Definitely. Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. And if I could say one thing to our members out there, I know your lives are busy. I get it. But do go to an international conference if you possibly can. It doesn't matter who you speak to at those conferences. And there's a huge swath of diversity amongst the members. Just take a moment and ask them about, you know, what brings them here. And it's the stories I have. Oh, you know, I remember meeting the Attorney General, I think that was her term, from Mexico. You know, those people, they're in danger, livelihood of their lives in their jobs. And I had the evening to spend with her, and I was just in awe.
And so I know that you go to a lot of conferences and you talk so highly of them. What specifically about them, besides the stories, do you find meaningful, and why do you think it's important that all of us attend at least one in our journey with IWF?
What a good question. I think it takes you away from your humdrum life, even though none of us have quiet lives. But sometimes you can get really embedded in things you got to do, mm-hmm. right? Especially with young families and so on. And it really takes you to another plane, and it makes you really understand that there are no barriers. That what women have stood for and continue to stand for, it just makes me so proud to be a woman, you know? And I have to really contrast that with how I felt when I grew up. Because I grew up in awe of the man's world. You know, I truly, really did. All of my influences on my life, other than obviously my mother, mm-hmm. Were men. But for me to transfer from that kind of mental state to saying that I'm just unearthly proud of being a woman is a lot to do with the IWF organization. Go to a conference, just even if you can only spend a day, go and experience what women are doing around the world.
You talked briefly a little bit about some of the jobs you've had over the years. I'd like to talk about your career sort of in the framework of leadership. So you've worked as a corporate executive, you've been part of a startup, the dean of Laurier Business School, and most recently the executive director at the Stratford campus for UW, which I think is a fascinating program. But can you talk to us a little bit about those different experiences? Sort of what did you enjoy most about them? What were your challenges? And do you have a different leadership style for each of those different types of industries?
Ooh, what a good question.
Or four.
I know.
Sorry,
I know.
We can break those down.
I have actually retired now four times. Honest to God, I have had four retirement speeches. So the first, of course, was corporate, and I joined not to be a leader by any stretch of the imagination. I loved puzzles, and I loved math. I'm math grad.
Yes.
And I loved IT. So IT was brand new when I hit the market. And so we're talking early 70s. Like, you guys weren't even born yet. Anyway.
Well, pretty close.
not. So, but what I found was that I loved the problem-solving part of IT, but what was happening in IT was it's a bunch of technicians, mm-hmm. and fairly clever mathematicians and computer scientists, and they didn't really know much about people. Just saying. So what happened, just, I guess, almost naturally, I there were two career tracks within Bell. I was in Bell Canada at the time, and one was to go up a technical route, which was really where I intended to go, and the other was up a management route. Mm-hmm. And so I was sucked into the management route, really almost more because it was such a vacuum on that side. You know, there really wasn't much. And so I ended up leading increasingly larger groups and groups and groups, and almost all guys. Mm-hmm. I mean, there were a few scattered women here or there, but I kept trying to grab jobs that were a little more interesting. I also had my children in around this yes. time as well. And so I had some challenges mm-hmm. at home, and I decided that I really needed to spend more time with my children. And there was no room for that. Like, even maternity leave was 6 weeks or something back then, you know. So I decided that I bargained. So I negotiated. They wanted some leadership out at the data center. And the data center is a little bit more of a factory yes. kind of environment. And I was really coming from downtown, you know, the architects, mm-hmm. system architects mm-hmm. and those kinds of things. And so I negotiated. I would go out and work there if they would let me have the summers off.
Oh.
And so.
It's a great idea. I should have thought of that.
I know. But they went for it.
Great.
And it was great, yes. too, because I had a very strong team members. And so it gave them each. I was 2 months. And so they gave them a month opportunity, a couple of them, to practice, you know, develop yes. their own leadership yes. skills. So it all worked out in the end. So I ended up out in the factory, mm-hmm. essentially. And when you think it's men, yeah. And it was really, really, really rude, shall I say. Yes. You know, they would put me on. I remember took me out to lunch once and took me to a strip club.
Oh, lovely.
Oh, good.
Lovely.
And worse than that, like, they would sat me at the table with my back to mm-hmm. the strippers, because they thought that was only right.
Yes.
You know what
they're
I mean?
They're being kind.
It's just unbelievable that yes. would happen now. But so I decided that my leadership style, which is what your original question was something I really had to concentrate on. Mm-hmm. And so out at the data center, it was military. Mm-hmm. You know, it was all just how fast, how whatever, aye, captain, you know. Mm-hmm. And that wasn't me
right.
in any way, shape, or form. And I didn't want to become, you know, the bitch, mm-hmm. you know, that many women did at that time to achieve success. So I sort of treated the district as a family. And so I remembered birthdays. So mm-hmm. I would actually go beyond that and sing to them.
Oh, wow.
I sang happy birthday to them. And of course, I couldn't get – and then my purview got larger and larger, and it got up to a couple of thousand. So you couldn't really go to visit them at their desk. So it was kind of funny, but I would sing them a voice message. Of course, this is Belle, right?
Right,
so
of course.
Leave a voice message. And it was so funny because on my birthday then, they brought the switch down because they had so many voice messages for me.
That's return. Fantastic.
So it really did work, you know, when you treat people as humans. And not to say that in crisis situations, you have to be able to make decisions quickly mm-hmm. and expediently and put your emotions on. There was a situation in Belle, for example, where Belle started to lay people off. Mm-hmm. And just to put this in context, Belle had never in the entire time it had lived, it had existed, it had never laid anyone off, even during the Depression.
Wow.
They went on work sharing mm-hmm. and so on. So this was a big, big deal for Belle. And they dropped 25% of the workforce, like just poof like that.
It's a big number.
So it's huge. Yeah. And people were really in shock. So we would get people together and just go around the table and ask people how they felt. Mm-hmm. And people came up with stories, you know, my dad got laid off and we ended up, you know, without a home. And they just get all of that baggage sort of thing, all that emotion out on the table and got through all of the tears. And then we said, okay, now that we've done that, now what are we actually going to do to make sure that we're respectful of the people that we place and so on and so forth?
So did that leadership style that you created at Belle, how did that transition to academia and how did you have to adjust it?
That's such a good question. So academia is just a completely different world. It truly, truly is. The closest I can come to it is to say it's sort of like a bunch of independent consultants that all work together. Mm-hmm. And the dean as you may know, all of the leadership positions are all elected by all the people there.
I didn't know that.
Nobody is kind of forced in ever with those kinds of organizations.
So you come from Bell. How then are you elected dean?
So I actually took 5 years in between there, and I worked at a high-tech startup, but we'll just put that aside for 1 minute.
We don't have time to talk about all the careers.
I'm sorry.
We'll need to know. It's great. We'll have to come back, and we'll do the other half of the careers.
And so I have had a very good friend, Carol Stevenson, who had I was on the board at Western, and Western Ivy School, the business school, needed a dean. And so I sort of talked her into the possibility of that. And she absolutely loved it. And she said, Jenny, I loved it so much. You should think about it too.
Oh.
And so that's sort of how the again, IWF.
Yes.
She's an IWF member, or was at the time. And then I put my hat in the ring, and they were up for something different. So, because I was not an academic, I had a master's, but I wasn't, I had no PhD. And by the way, I should say that my father has a PhD, and he was a prof in a university. My mother has her PhD, was a prof in a university.
Wow, that's
my
a lot to live up
to. My brother has a PhD, prof in a university, and my sister. So I was the only one.
But then you got to be the dean.
I know. It still irks them no end.
I'm sure it does.
So there, it was a very different kind of leadership. And I felt fairly strongly there that change was really required at the school. There was nothing wrong with it. It's a fabulous university, fabulous school. But it was when I arrived, it was very much an accounting school.
Oh.
And I really felt that there was, of course, an accounting school that was developed at the University of Waterloo.
Yes.
And there was a lot of kind of friction and stuff between it. And I'm going, you know, I think that we need more than just accounting. I mean, I totally get how important accountants are. I'm on the CPA board. So I truly do understand that. But what was required a little more, I thought, was some kind of training in and around management of technology specifically. And it was just about that time that some rather tough management decisions were taken within BlackBerry. So it really was front and center of many people's thoughts. And I talked to a lot of high-tech industries, and what they continued to tell me was that they didn't have any source of management expertise within the corporation. So we developed a new program called the Executive Management, Executive Masters in Technology Management. And it was sort of like an MBA, but it was much more directioned at high tech.
Right.
So that was in my brain as the strategy. And it, by the way, it wasn't just my strategy. I did a lot of listening to a lot of the folks in the community and so on and so forth, what was needed. It's possible I didn't do enough listening to the professors, because universities are, you know, they're slow and ponderous in their decision-making processes, which I came to appreciate, to be quite honest, because in industry, you make a decision, bang, like that, and you push it through, right? And you have all kinds of tools to do that. You don't have those tools in an institution of higher learning. It's much more collaborative, and hence the slowness of the decisions. But the amazing thing is that once a decision is taken, it's really ingrained, unlike in industry. You know, you end up with a new VP, and all of a sudden, poof, all of that goes out the window and
start over
and
again.
That really doesn't happen in a university. So it makes it a much more
stable. Is collaboration lend itself to continuity then a little bit?
Much more so. Much more so. Now, it's still, it's ultra hard to bring change, though.
I can imagine,
To that kind of thing.
So on the topic of change then, you moved to the executive director at in Stratford, and you launch a brand new program.
Brand new school.
Brand new program.
That's okay.
Approaching, you know, digital media.
Yep.
What was it like starting that? And after you just said in academia how it works, how were you able to start something like that? And it launched fairly quickly, is
yes,
my understanding.
It did. Yep.
So how were you able to pull all of that together?
Well, it was I was actually brought in to kind of pull up the bootstraps a little bit of the organization. There had already been quite a few ideas in place, and it was modeled after a program out of UBC. Mm-hmm. And it all ties around the fact that with high tech, unfortunately, as luck would have it, you've got a user involved. Mm-hmm. High tech would be great if it weren't for the user.
Yes.
Right? Yeah. Okay. But hey, guess what? You've got a user. And that user has to interface with that technology in some way, shape, or form. But that's not how the school actually started. The school actually started with a lot of money and encouragement from OpenText. So I was brought in to really bring it together, get the programs launched, build a new building, and, you know, set the school up, essentially. So when I got there, I had a lot of interface with Silicon Valley. What I found was that there were such things as UX engineers, mm-hmm. they called them, but they were six-figure salaries, right? And California, big six-figure salaries, because there was no program producing these people. They were either tech people that happened to have a pretty strong right brain and kind of understood things about human behavior, human nature, or they were people who came in from the arts and had a real bent toward tech. But all of those would be mid-career type individuals. Mm. And so by that time, their salaries were well advanced. So what we tried to do was to produce a graduate that really had really good, strong grounding on both. So both the tech and the understanding how people need to receive information. Mm-hmm. And so it was inordinately successful, I have to say. And everybody says, oh, good work, Ginny. No. It was a huge gang that I worked with. That's first. And second, how many things do you get involved with that really don't work out? Right?
Yes.
And you take your lumps.
Yep.
So when the planets line up, damn it, like, go for it.
That's right.
And that's what we did. So we were able to bring corporations in, and that was really our secret sauce.
Yes.
So we brought every corporation. I just went through my Rolodex and just pulled them all out. And there were some pretty heavy hitters in there that really loved what we were trying to do. And each one of those kids ended up with a co-op kind of placement. And of course, they just got eaten up by Amazon came along. And this would have been pretty well 10 years ago, right? And, you know, Amazon was coming along, but it was really still kind of sleepy and so on. Well, they were just all over our students. I couldn't believe it. Like, they were hiring them left, right, and center. And I'm going, something's going on here. You know the big university fair?
Yes.
In Toronto?
Yes. At the convention center. Yes,
exactly.
Very well aware.
Yeah, there you go. So I would stand there.
Oh, yes.
Yep. Oh, yeah, you would be. I would stand there and parents would come up to me with tears in their eyes, said, I want my son to have this kind of experience, but all he wants to do is play on the computer. Mm-hmm. And I go,
we can do both.
We might have a program.
We might have something.
So it's change. It's getting kind of back to your original question about leadership style. You really do have to alter your leadership style. And I think women do that well. Mm-hmm. We tend to have much stronger EQ, which men often see as a weakness because they say, well, you can't be tough enough. We can be damn tough, mm-hmm. you know. But I think it's important to read your audience.
Oh, I like that advice. It's very good. So the Stratford campus only represents your most recent career that revolves around technology. Through your experiences, what do you think the impact of technology is on focus and memory?
Ooh, I have to tell you, that's a particularly important thing for me right now, because in my retirement, I am focusing on many things around fitness, and one is fitness of the brain. And I've definitely noticed a propensity to have memory issues. So I've been doing a lot of reading and a lot of research in the area.
And what have you found?
Well, I have found the following. Your brain is an organ, right? We all know that. But it really reacts more like a muscle. So, you know, the old thing, you use it or you lose it. Mm-hmm. And that's absolutely true of the brain. And I think just to focus on the negative side, I think tech, and particularly, I'm holding up my iPhone right now,
yes,
is a particular damaging, has a damaging effect on your brain. And you're going, why? Well, I remember the old days, you know, before these things existed, and we would sit around and we go, play Trivial Pursuit or something. We go, so what was the year that, you know, or what was the name? And you'd really work your brain to try to figure now. Nobody does that, right? You just got talked to.
We wait 30 seconds and we look it up.
Siri. You know. That's right. So I think that, and lists, right? Lists on lists on lists on lists. So what I've been trying to do is to wean myself. And I'm saying that having a list right in front of me, right? Just being honest.
Well, it's a work in progress, right?
It's a work in progress. So everything is. All things in life, right? I'm really trying to use my brain more. So I found the following, that your brain really was never designed to work with words. It was designed to work in images and locations, believe it or not.
I have read that. I read one of the best things for your brain is to not use GPS.
Yes, exactly. And I am, I'll use GPS to go home. You
I
know what
too.
I mean? From here.
Yes.
That's ridiculous.
I just want to beat the time, actually.
Me too. You and me both.
Yeah.
So if you provide your brain with those kinds of cues rather than words. So all the way through school, we're taught rote memorization, right? Remember the words. Remember the numbers.
Remember the formula.
Exactly.
Which I am not a fan of at all.
Exactly. And so there's a number of books. One of them is called Limitless, and by James Quick, I think.
We'll put it in the show notes. We'll check.
Yeah, okay.
I'll find it. Great.
So what they encourage you to do is if you really want to remember something, say a person's name, and I'm terrible.
Me too. Horrible at
trying to remember people's names. And so I go out for a walk every morning. Fitness, big thing for me. And I keep bumping into this woman. So I finally asked her name, right? And her name was Liz. I normally would just walk on and forget like two steps later. But this book tells you to, or this theory tells you to develop an image in your brain around the name, right? So Liz became Lizard. So I have this, you know, image of a lizard, and then her address was 222, the street that we walk on. And so I put on the lizard, on the back of the lizard, you know, three twos sort of thing. Do you know that that was probably, I don't know, 3 months ago when I started looking at this whole thing? And no problem at all. I can remember her name. No problem at all. And so there's a bunch of techniques that you can use. Location is another one. And I guess that's designed so that you can find your way back home to your cave, you know, as primitive primates. They call them memory castles.
Yes.
Memory palaces.
Yes, yeah. Memory palace.
Yeah.
Yes. And I've read a lot about those.
Okay. And so just for the listeners, you just determine certain location that you really know very, very well. And so you come in the front door and you hook your first number on the list up to, you know, something, the front doorknob. You go through the house and to the bathroom, you hook another of your grocery items up. And you do that and try to use as much imagery in your brain as possible. But getting back to the question, I do think that technology has not served us well, even though I love it.
Yes.
And I am just seriously never without. I dropped my iPhone in the lake.
Oh, no.
Unbeknownst to me, right? So I get back to we were taking the grandkids out water skiing, and I guess it was in my pocket, and it just slipped out. I found it with Find My
Pinging under the water?
Yep, it was. But do you think we could find it? No. We drove down, couldn't find it. So I was probably about 2 days without my phone, and I thought I was going to die.
I actually think that that's a nice perspective, though, because often when we talk about technology and the dangers of technology, it's quite, you're either don't have it at all, or I use it all the time.
Yep.
You know, to hear someone like yourself, which is probably like most of us, recognize that possibly we shouldn't be on it as much, but that we do need it, or we do like to have it, and we're working on it.
Yeah,
that makes the rest of us feel that that's an accomplishable task.
Yeah, I really believe it is, and like anything in life, you know.
Yes.
Everything in moderation. Right?
Everything in moderation. I'd like to circle back to IWF for a minute. The IWF Canada Luminary Award recognizes IWF Canada members who have best exemplified the spirit and soul of IWF Canada, which you obviously do, and you are one of the most recent recipients of the Luminary Award this past June. What was that experience like?
My God, I was gobsmacked when I got called. You know, how can I say this? Like, IWF for me is something that does things for me. I don't do it for it. I can't really express this very well, but there are people out there that spend inordinate time, you know, organizing podcasts and dine arounds and so on and so forth. And not that I haven't rolled my sleeves up on a few occasions in that regard as well, but I see IWF as something that's only helped me. And for them to turn around and recognize me, I was absolutely floored. I mean, there's just no other word for it. And I guess it had to do with the fact of starting the chapter.
Mm-hmm,
but I also gather that when people went out to get supporters for it, that there were a whole bunch of people that supported it. So I guess there is some truth to it.
So did Sarah call you?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
What did she say?
Oh, she said, oh, you've been selected. Or maybe it was a text.
A text.
Yeah, yeah. And she said, on my great iPhone, and she said, you know, you've been selected as the Luminary Award. And I mean, honestly, I had to read it like 4 times to say, are you serious? Like it just, there wasn't even, I had no idea, of course, that the initiative was there. And
I think that's the point, right?
Yeah.
Yes.
But I was hugely honored. I feel, though, guilty, because I just see all the other people out there doing so much for the organization. And I've really stepped back in the past few years, and because I thought it was important to have other people lead the organization. Succession planning, right? That's
yes.
the key.
Yes. Not
key
always
to good
successful.
Governance. Yeah, not always successful and tough to do.
Yes.
Really tough to do. That was one of the hardest things I had to do actually in the chapter, because I loved it so much and I was just so much into it. But I realized that it was important to step back and let somebody else take the reins. At that stage, I sort of stepped back from the organization and I've just been taking from it. I don't give back to it that much. So,
well, congratulations.
Thank
it's
you
well
so
deserved.
Very much. Thank you.
On that idea, though, of stepping back, what do you think is next for women in leadership?
Oh, you know, that's such an important, you just sparked such an important point for me. I have seen such development. I mean, seriously, I in one of my early years in Bell Canada, I can remember going to the corporate headquarters in Montreal, and there was no women's washroom on the board floor.
Wow.
Like, seriously.
That's... Yeah.
And just a few years before my hiring, a woman could not hold a higher position than something like a senior clerk or something like that. You know, it just couldn't happen. So, I mean, I've witnessed all of this, and I've witnessed the very slow but steady
yes.
rise of women in, especially in big corporate Canada, mm-hmm. in Toronto. And the corporation's doing so well as a result of women lending their voice to the decision-making processes. But I'm really, 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 really nervous that we're going to start to backtrack. So remember that when this happened, you know, in my career, it was growth. Everything in Canada was growing. So it's easier, maybe, to throw some wild cards in there when you're growing and every, you know, it's all roses and sunshine. But when things get tight, people tend to go back to much more of a militaristic or a command and control kind of environment. And women are not normally seen as having a good, I mean, strong contributions in that kind of thing in war. Right.
Right. And control, too. If the circle is tighter, you want to maintain control and you don't want someone that might suggest change or bring a better way to do it.
Exactly. You just do as I say.
Correct.
Yeah. And so you blend that together with the reactionary political movements. Mm-hmm. Wait a minute. In the world. And I don't think we as Canadians can sit back and think that it's not going to be happening here as well. And it's, abortion, but it's not about abortion, but it's about somebody trying to exert control.
It's control
over me. Yeah. I'm sorry, but I make my decisions. I'm a human being, and I am just in fear.
I agree.
I'm
not sure where everything's going.
Speechless.
And, you know, you probably have granddaughters and I have a daughter.
Uh-huh,
and
yes, definitely.
It's a concern.
It is a huge concern. So I think that if anything, IWF has to really batten down the hatches and say that we absolutely have to fight for our place in the world. I think it's going to be a really tough go. I really do. But I'm starting to see little things happening at the Detroit conference. Go to conferences. the governor of Michigan
that must have been
addressed
very
us,
interesting.
Gretchen Whitmer.
Yes.
Oh, my goodness. So here's a woman who has been maligned.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, threats of kidnap, of death, not only herself, but her family. And she just keeps her head up. She is just such a remarkable woman. And, you know, we are approximately 50% of the population.
Yes,
so
we are.
If we get out and vote,
yes,
maybe we could have more control over ourselves. And I think that's what it's all about. So I've been very heartened in my work at the universities to see young women. As a matter of fact, even the business program is now, I don't know what it is right now, but when I was there, it was more than 50% women. And the leaders within the school, they're almost all women. And these are women that don't even give it another thought. Like in my day, I would do it. I would run for student council president or whatever, but I'd kind of always be looking over my shoulder and thinking, well, what are they thinking about me, you know, as a woman? The young women today don't have to worry about things like that. They're just being, you know, they're being themselves. But I think as leaders and elders,
yes,
speaking only for myself,
no,
Amy.
I understand. I'm getting very close to that. It's so good.
No, you're not. I think it's incumbent upon us to make sure that we really do continue to encourage. So in any of our walks in life, including our own daughters, if there's anything that we can do to encourage young women and take a chance, you know, just take a chance and promote that young woman or hire that young woman, I don't think you'll be disappointed. And it will hopefully keep this reactionary, misogynistic
climate,
political control at bay.
So my last question for you then is, what advice do you have for the next generation of women leaders?
Yeah, just don't be afraid. And I know that sounds so stupid to say, but I spent my entire life being nervous, you know, about, well, what will they think if I do this? Or put that to one side. Your life and your ability to change the world is just absolutely paramount. And you've got everything that you need to do that. Just wade in and just do it. And there's an expression that was taught to me in Bell, actually, many, many years ago by a rather salty individual who said, do your homework, never tell a lie, and don't take any shit from anybody.
That's great advice. And a great way to stop. I think that's fantastic. Thank you very much, Ginny.
Oh, thanks so much for doing this first, Amy. I think it is going to make a huge difference to our chapter and to the organization writ large, hopefully. And thank you very much for including me on your list. I'm honored.
Well, we're very happy to have you as our first guest, and we appreciate you helping us get the podcast off the ground. So we're excited to see where we can go from here.
Me too. Thanks so much, Amy.
Thank you for listening today. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to rate and subscribe to our podcast. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so more leaders can find us and be inspired by the stories our Voices of Leadership have to share. If you would like to connect with us, please visit the Voices of Leadership website. The link can be found in our show notes, available wherever you listen to podcasts.